I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 174 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I might even autograph it. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And now for some feedback from Matt on Facebook. David, in the closing segment of your recent show on sexual abuse, I heard you say something like men are more prone to violence than women. It's my understanding that in regard to domestic violence, the rate of violence by both genders is roughly equal. But of course, men can inflict much more damage due to their greater physical strength. In violence in general, outside the domestic violence context, men have a much higher rate than women. But again, how much of that is due to the physical strength attributes as opposed to attitudinal factors, I don't know. I'm certainly not suggesting it's an incorrect statement on your part, but some of this nuance seemed not to be part of the discussion. I do really appreciate your openness to comment from your listeners, so I thought I would take you up on this one. Thanks, Matt. And now let's go to our interview. David Rasnick is a PhD in chemistry, where he focused on the protease inhibitors that he doesn't think should be used on people with AIDS. He has expertise in AIDS, arthritis, the proteases, as I mentioned, drug design and clinical diagnostics, and cancer, which we'll talk about today. He's founded several biotech companies, synthesized the first peptidyl fluoromethanes, which I have no clue what they are, was a member of Thabo Mbeki's South African Presidential Advisory Panel on HIV and AIDS, and invented data analysis, the first quantitative theory of biological change. Since 1996, he's researched the aneuploidy theory of cancer, sometimes with Peter Duisberg. I interviewed him on this subject in the Infectious Myth episodes 5 and 1, in episode 5. You can also read his book, Chromosomal Imbalance Theory of Cancer. But now he wants to publish a new book, a book on his theories of the origin of cancer for a more general audience. That's you, audience. Welcome to the show, Dr. Rasnick. I will call you Raz from now on, and you can call me Crowe, since that's what we normally do, so we won't get confused.
And neither will the audience. Okay, thanks, Crowe. It's good to be back.
Yes. So let's start with some basic cell biology. I'm sure people all learned this in high school. Well, I'm sure the words came out of the biology teacher's mouth. Whether they went into the brain of the high school students is another question. But I think people now realize what then seemed pretty theoretical and irrelevant, it actually is pretty important as you're an aging adult and you have to worry about things like cancer. So most cells in the body have a nucleus that contains DNA and a set of chromosomes. So how many chromosomes do humans normally have?
Well, humans have exactly 23 pairs of chromosomes, 23 coming from the mother and 23 coming from the father, for a total of 46. the collection of chromosomes are species-specific and defining.
Right, right. I know when I was studying plants, plants have a habit of doubling the number of chromosomes, and so even closely related species often have dramatically different numbers of chromosomes, but within the species, they're generally very consistent.
That's right, yeah.
I think animals are a little bit different. They don't tend to change chromosome numbers as frequently.
There are some species, like some amphibians and some others, that can be polyploid, for example.
Right,
like the plants.
Right.
The plants have balanced chromosomes, basically, even though they have multiple copies, a lot more than people do.
Right.
But they're still balanced. They're not unbalanced, except in their zygotes. They can
right.
be aneuploid.
Oh, okay. So what happens if you're born with too many or too few chromosomes?
Well, we know for a fact that if you have too many, for example, and you are born alive, you're probably either Down syndrome with three copies of the smallest chromosome, 21, or either, I think it's 18, chromosome 18, and I believe the other one is 16, I don't remember. But anyway, there's only three types of aneuploid chromosomes that you can be born with and be alive. The ones, only the Down syndrome kids with three copies of chromosome 21 actually can live even nowadays as old as into their 60s. Back in the 70s, though, they rarely reached their 20s.
Right, right. So, obviously, not having the right number of chromosomes is not really a good thing. Now, one question I came up with when I wrote, most cells in the body have a nucleus. There are some cells that don't have a nucleus, right?
Yeah, some of the blood cells, like red blood cells, for example, don't have a nucleus.
Right, and we're going to be talking about chromosomes and cancer. So are there red blood cell cancers?
No.
Interesting.
There are white blood cell cancers, which definitely do have nuclei.
Right. That is actually fascinating because there's so much blood in our body. You'd think if there was an opportunity to have cancer, red blood cell cancer would be pretty common. So when a cell divides, that's the process called mitosis that you were supposed to remember in high school. I'm sure it was on one of your exams. And the two cells should be identical after mitosis, right?
Yeah, usually. Normally. Rarely they aren't, though.
Right. Okay, and then there's another process called meiosis, which is where it's the merger of genetic material, like in the egg and the sperm, correct?
That's not meiosis. That's fertilization.
Fertilization. Okay, what's meiosis?
Meiosis is where you now reduce the number of chromosomes. Remember, you have to reduce the number from 46 down to 23 in the sperm and 46 down to 23 in the egg.
Okay. Well, obviously, it's been a long time since high school or university in my case.
Right.
Okay, so you reduce the number of chromosomes, and now that produces the egg or the sperm that have half the normal number. And then, of course, when they get together and fertilize, as you said, then you get back to the normal number of chromosomes, hopefully.
Yep.
And that is what creates the mixture of male and female chromosomes in most human beings. Okay, so let's say mitosis doesn't work properly, and the two cells are not identical, what kinds of things can happen?
Well, if they're not identical, then they're aneuploid. That means they have an unbalanced complement of chromosomes. They do not have exactly 23 pairs of the normal human chromosomes. Like in Down syndrome, for example, they have two of each chromosome except for chromosome 21, where they have three, and that's aneuploid. Other than those chromosomes, the cell almost always dies, other than the chromosome 21. It's usually, if you have, there's no example of anybody being born with three copies of chromosome 1. That's the largest chromosome with about 2,000 genes. And that screws everything up. As soon as you have an imbalance of chromosomes, the cell is damaged. It's abnormal.
Right.
And if it's not too big a hit of aneuploidy, it might survive and hang around for a while, metabolize. It may even divide. but typically they don't work very well, and they usually just die out. On occasion, they don't, and then they, if they don't die out, and if they are able to divide, then they generate more cells that are aneuploid or have different balances of chromosomes, unbalanced. And every time these cells divide, and if they continue to survive, you keep propagating the imbalance such that you keep scrambling the chromosomes every time.
That's an important question. So if a aneuploid cell undergoes mitosis, it does not produce two identical cells.
If it does not, I'm sorry, say it.
So if an aneuploid cell undergoes cell division or mitosis, the two cells that it produces do not have identical chromosomes.
No, they're aneuploid. They don't ever go back to normal.
Right. So you've irrevocably destabilized the genome.
That's right.
And you will never sort of go back to a normal state, and then everything's good again, and the bad cells die out. So the protection really is that the majority of these cells die.
That's right.
And therefore they can't do any harm. So we how long have we known that every cancer cell is aneuploid?
Well, I think the late 19th century, when David Hanselman, all of the epithelial cancers, most human cancers come from the epithelial cells. Epithelial cells are lining cells, basically, and they divide a lot. They're very active cells. And every one of the epithelial cancers that he looked were aneuploid. They had an unbalanced number of chromosomes. They had some cells would have lower numbers, some cells would have higher numbers, and they were in every one of the cancers that he looked at. In fact, to this day, there is no confirmed example of a cancer that has normal, balanced 23 pairs of chromosomes. They just don't exist.
I mean, this is one of the most incredible things. I mean, what happened with this observation? You would think people would say, aha, now we know what makes cancer different than normality.
Right at that same time, a colleague of David Hanselman was Theodor Boveri, another German, and he was a developmental biologist, and he did a lot of his experimental work on sea urchin embryos, and he studied aneuploidy a lot, not in cancer, but in the sea urchins, and he could generate aneuploidy in those sea urchin embryos. And he understood chromosomal imbalance very well, and he developed a theory that he wrote in a small little book, a monograph in 1914 in German. And basically he laid out in that book the chromosomal imbalance theory of cancer. He didn't call it chromosomal imbalance at the time, as a theory. He did note that they're unbalanced chromosomes, though. And he postulated that those unbalanced chromosomes caused cancer, because he had experimentally demonstrated that each chromosome of the different types, you know, we have 23 different ones,
right.
Each one of our chromosomes has unique properties from the other ones. And he had experimentally demonstrated that, and so he knew that principle, that all the chromosomes are different. And you need at least one copy of each chromosome for a cell to be viable. I don't know of any example of a cell that is missing both copies, you know, totally missing a single chromosome. I don't think they're viable. I don't know of any that are. So you have to have at least one copy of every chromosome for the cell to be viable.
Okay, so would that mean that when aneuploid cells divide, presumably there'd be quite a few cells produced that are missing a chromosome, and that there would be a high death rate amongst aneuploid cells?
You can get errors where cells will just spontaneously, for no particular reason, because nothing's perfect, and you can get accidental production of aneuploid cells, but you really need populations of aneuploid cells in order to generate that molecular or chromosomal lottery where you wind up with the combination that will lead to cancer. The real issue here with cancer is that it's almost virtually all caused environmentally. You have to have exogenous carcinogens. You have to have a constant exposure to carcinogens in order to generate enough abnormal cells, enough aneuploid cells, in order for it to catch fire, you know, and you generate some that actually survive and keep going.
Okay, well,
so cancer is an environmentally caused disease.
Yes. Okay. So I want to talk about that because we can talk about aneuploidy being the cause of cancer versus mutations, but in reality, it's the thing that causes the aneuploidy, which would be an environmental, chemical, physical substances, radiation, things like that that would cause this. But let's talk about what's the mainstream belief about cancer formation, which is that it's based on mutations. So what's the difference between a mutation and aneuploidy?
Okay, I'll be a little bit specific. Most of the mutations most cancer researchers, certainly in the United States, are talking about are what are called point mutations or single nucleotide mutations, changing one nucleotide for another one, for example, something like that, very, very small. They're what they call molecular biologists. They're thinking in terms of molecules and very minute things. And they're thinking that, of the genes, there's about 20,000 human genes. And mice, by the way, have the same 20,000, virtually identical. 99% of the mouse genes are shared by humans. And they serve the same functions and everything. But yet, from those functionally equivalent genes, you get a mouse or you get a human. So that difference is not in the genes. It's how they're orchestrated, how they function is what determines whether or not a fertilized mouse egg is going to turn into a mouse and a fertilized human egg is going to turn into a human. It's not the genes. It's the activities, the interconnected, interrelated activities of all those genes that determine not only a species, but is involved in determining whether or not a cell is going to become a liver or a kidney or a neuron or a muscle cell and so on and so forth. They're not genes for the liver, not genes for the heart, not genes for the muscle. All these cells have the same genes. It's how they're working together that determines what cell type there is. Now, how does that come about? Well, that's a big mystery. It's one of the big unsolved mysteries that there is. But we know that all these cells have the same genes. So how do they turn into these different cells? They have all their neighbors. You know, the little egg is growing up in the womb and developing in the womb of the same species. Not only do species have species-specific chromosomes, they also have what's called chromosome locales. It's where the chromosomes, the relative position that the chromosomes exist in the nucleus. They're species-specific. Now, as the species-specific in the egg, the species-specific chromosomes start dividing and everything, the chromosomes move around inside the nucleus and change position, and they have new locales, and then it's this reorchestration of the chromosomes, which leads to a reorchestration of the messenger RNA that's produced, and then the proteins, and so on and so forth, that produce the different tissues and the different cells.
Right.
Such that each tissue has a tissue-specific locale for chromosomes. It's like you have a different you have the same instruments, but you arrange them differently. If you want to be a liver or if you want to be a colon, et cetera, et cetera.
So
even though you have the exact same instruments.
By locale, that you're talking about the position of the chromosomes within the nucleus, their relative position.
That's right. And there's the fact that they're tissue specific is important. I'm not trying to tell you that I or anybody else understands all the details and how all this happens. All we know is all the genes are the same. What is changing are the chromosomes. And the orchestration of the expression of these genes on the chromosomes, which are dependent on the locale of the chromosomes inside the nucleus. It's also dependent on where these cells are located next to other cells. They communicate with each other.
Right.
It's a mystery of the first order how this happens.
I know this is going off topic, but have people been able to implant embryos from one species into another? And does that what happens when you do that?
I think they have. Now, I haven't followed that closely, but yeah. I think that's been done. But I think it has to be a pretty closely related species. Now, the cells, it'll be like an in vitro experiment. I know I've seen, read some of this, where the cells will divide, just like in the laboratory. You can even take a fertilized egg and have it divide several times or a number of times in vitro.
Right.
And then it will stop at some point because it's no longer, it's not in the womb, it's not being nourished by the womb, and all of the other communications that go in there. So I'm pretty sure that that's what probably goes on when you put these eggs in a different species. That's not my area of expertise.
Right, which we would call a spontaneous abortion, right?
Fetus. In fact, that's usually what happens to Down syndrome. They're almost always spontaneously aborted. It doesn't take much to be out of whack to screw everything up.
Right. So you talked about point mutations. So is it one mutation that's supposed to cause a cancer, or how does this theory explain it?
Nobody believes that anymore. That was when they had back in the 70s, and they started, Peter Duesberg is one of the first actually to identify a so-called oncogene. Oncogene was supposedly a gene that all by itself has the power to turn a normal cell into a cancer cell. Those were called dominant oncogenes. And they thought it took just a single one of those things to work. And nobody's ever been able to demonstrate that. So then they say, oh, well, then it must be two or three or I think up to seven gene mutations. They all have to be in the same cell, which mathematically makes it horrendously unlikely. In fact, virtually impossible.
That's an important observation because, your body is probably getting mutations that are relatively... you got trillions of cells in your body, you're probably getting relatively frequent mutations. But if you need seven in the same cell, that's asking a lot.
And you've got 9 billion nucleotides, too,
Right.
So instead of 52 cards, you got, nine billion or something like that.
I think we'll have trouble with the numbers if we try to figure this out.
3 billion, I forget the exact number, yeah. But it's a huge number. And you start scrambling them all up. And not only that, that's how many nucleotides. And then you've got, 10 to the 14 cells.
This is really necessary to explain why everybody's not dying of cancer, right? Because if you need to get seven mutations, that dramatically reduces the probability of it happening.
Yeah, but that's not even the biggest reason. I mean, that is alone. That is sufficient to rule out the gene mutation theory.
Right.
But based on what Theodore Boveri, what he did back in 1914 and what we picked up, other people over the years, Wingi, George Papanicolaou, Peter and I did in the late 90s, reviving this thing, it turns out that there is no way a few genes, I don't care if they're normal genes or mutated genes, they just do not have the power. It's impossible for those genes, whatever genes you pick, it doesn't matter, they do not have the power to turn a normal cell into a cancer cell. If they did, everybody would have cancer all the time. Probably life would not be possible on this planet, advanced species or metazoans, with lots of cells would not be possible. And I think basically a lot of the people, the cancer researchers know this and understand it, but they don't know what to do about it. They can only get their grants funded to look for more oncogenes or tumor suppressor genes or genome-wide associations. Whatever it is, it has to do with genes. They're so fixated with genes that they can't get away from aneuploidy because the cancer cells are always aneuploid. So you can't get away from it. You can't find a diploid cancer cell to study because they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So they've started looking, trying to make aneuploidy be responsible for the gene mutations. That's what people, they look into what's called these breakpoints where the chromosomes break apart and they produce what are called marker chromosomes. And they totally ignore the 10 to 50 extra chromosomes in the cancer cell and look at this one gene that was split when a chromosome's broken.
So they can't see the forest for the trees.
That's exactly what it is.
I mean, I understood that the reason why the aneuploidy theory was rejected was really because there was no consistent pattern, that the number of chromosomes in cancer cells varied dramatically, and so therefore...
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of... I wonder...
No, two cancer cells are alike. Every cancer cell is different.
But I think sometimes with humans, it's like we're always looking. It's almost It's almost part of science that there will be a simple explanation. And so
Yes,
when we...
reductionism. It's
Right.
reductionism. They were hoping that biology would be similar to physics,
Right.
you know, where you could find a single cause for a single consequence. And it just doesn't exist in biology.
Now, this is a serious diversion, but you mentioned 1914 for Boveri.
Right.
I was also fascinated by two other what appear to be scientific errors that occurred at almost the same time. One of them was the discovery of the Piltdown Man, which was, I think, 1913 or 1914, which
right.
was this fake skull that was believed up to the 1950s to be, you know, the missing link. And it would have placed the origin of humanity in England, which was great for the English Empire at its peak before it all
right.
fell apart with the First World War. The second mistake was Alfred Wegener came up with a theory of continental drift around 1913 and 14. And it was literally the end of your career as a geologist if you talked about this up until
right.
the 1960s.
Right.
So now we got, like, what was it about that little bit of time scientifically before the First World War that caused people to come up with these important either important advances that were rejected or errors that were accepted?
Yeah, I tell you, the 19th century was an amazing century, and the early 20th century. It was just a ferment in physics, biology. Think of it, everything. You had, I think, an optimal level of informed, educated, capable people that had the freedom. You know, even Einstein, he was in the patent office, but he had the freedom there to, you know, publish five extraordinary papers in 1 year. I think it was 1905
right.
or something like that,
right.
you know. And basically, it was a hobby of his, you know. He wasn't in an academic place at all. And so you had all these wonderful, these magnificent scientists in the 19th century. The thermodynamics, the electromagnetic theory of radiation, you know, physics, biology, you know, had Darwin. It was just a very vital area. And during this period, guess what it was? It was not institutional science. These were individual people.
Right.
It was small enough. You had, these people had enough freedom. They had enough wherewithal to survive and also have the freedom to think and to write and to do stuff. And now we have institutional science. Ever since World War II, institutional science is totally is dominated, and it's kill science.
Well, two of those things I cited were theories that were rejected, continental drift
yes.
and aneuploidy.
Right.
And
right.
now, of course, continental drift is called plate tectonics, and the geologists
right.
like to pretend that
right.
they invented it,
right.
even though they suppressed it for about 50 years, 40,
yep.
50 years.
Right.
But the mistake was the Piltdown Man, which was actually a very institutional scientist. I forget his name, but he was like the top archaeologist, anthropologist in the world.
Right.
And he controlled everything. And it was his level of control that allowed
right.
this error to exist for about 40 years before somebody
yeah.
drilled a hole in the skull and realized that the bone inside was white, which meant that it was obviously not in the ground for a long time. But anyway, we've gone a long time, but I think you're right that certainly by the end of the Second World War, institutional science had taken over.
Right.
And
we're suffering from that to this day. It's freedom of scientific inquiry and thought, even discourse, is pretty much dead in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you can certainly, your voice can be suppressed if you have any concerns about vaccines, or if you have concerns about mainstream cancer therapy, if you obviously, as we know very well, if you question whether HIV causes AIDS, I mean, these are things that derail your career. The empire definitely strikes back. If you're, say, an MD or a PhD who suddenly decides that one of these major theories is wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we're about in the situation that when the Catholic Church ruled the world you know, around the 1600s or whatever it was, or 1600s, you know, and they could control thought, and right. they could burn you at the stake, you know, and Galileo, and, you know, everybody knows that story. And basically, we're in the situation right now where we have mega control of thought and discourse and funding, and through the National Institutes of Health, the big pharmaceutical companies. It's just that it's that's the problem that we face with trying to do science or do anything creative.
Right, right. I mean, even if like, let's say that the anthropogenic global warming theory is correct, does that mean that we should suppress everybody who questions it, or is it possible that we could learn and that the theory overall might not be totally correct? Like, even if, say, you were wrong about aneuploidy, maybe the establishment could learn from you. But of course, their fear probably is that you're right. And yeah, therefore, you have to be suppressed.
That's the big thing. I really encourage people to read this long essay by John Stuart Mill on liberty. He addresses that very question, that he's a strong advocate, and I totally agree with him. Doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong, all voices should be voiced. Because if you're right, you've got nothing to lose, and sometimes the wrong opinion, there are generally some aspects that everybody can contribute. And if you're wrong, you need to be tweaked, you know, into looking at another way or seeing it. You need to keep the alternatives up there.
Well, yeah, I look at it like American politics has ossified into this two-party system. And so everything is the, you know, red versus blue, the Democrat versus Republican. But what is the political party in America that's against war? Well, it's not one of those two parties. So therefore, the debate about, you know, should America be at war all the time is suppressed, because you got to talk about the Democrats will be better than the Republicans or vice versa. And I think similarly, the discussions in science have been reduced to a smaller and smaller acceptable area of discourse.
Yeah. That's what's happening. That's what's happening with cancer, vaccines, as you point out, with AIDS, with virtually every area. And, you know, so that's one reason why I'm writing my book. It's one
yes.
reason why I wrote the one for scientists. At least it's out there. So it's there's a record. And mm-hmm. now I want to do the same thing for the public. I'm writing this book as a citizen.
Right.
You know, I'm doing this as a citizen.
Okay.
To get this out there for people.
So you have an Indiegogo campaign, right?
Mm-hmm. I do. It started January 31st. It ends on St. Patrick's Day.
Okay. And so let me just pull it up. What cancer really is. So you have
right.
a video there. And of course, yeah. people can get even more information if they listen to this podcast, and depending on how much you give, you can get like your name in the book. You can get a ebook copy when it comes out. So how is this going to help people if people help to fund this book, or they get a copy of this book?
How is
it going to help?
Yeah, what's the point? Yeah, the purpose of this.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose is to raise money to allow me to finish, polish, refine this book. I've already have a draft. It's 178-page draft, 7 chapters, but it needs polishing. It needs to be made readable, and I have to make it just absolutely as clear as possible.
And what about figures and things like that?
Figures, I have to get it illustrated. What was it? Richard Feynman said, you know, you should be able to explain, if you understand it well enough, any scientific theory to a 10-year-old. And I agree with him about
mm-hmm.
that, you know. And I'm going to do my best to try to explain cancer. It's actually, oddly enough, cancer is like a superb magic trick that's just totally blows people away. It's really, really mysterious. But behind it all, it's very simple and obvious and clear to anybody. Once you see it, once you get it, you go, oh, my God, hit yourself up the side of the head. Why didn't I see that? It's that that's type of thing.
Right.
Oh, my dog just came back in.
Okay. Well,
yeah, we'll keep going though.
Yeah. No, that's okay. I like authenticity on this, so I don't necessarily.
We got authenticity here. It's got four legs and a lot of hair.
Okay. Well, that's good. So one question I wanted to ask is, you talked about environmental carcinogens. So the question is, there are mutagens, things that cause mutations, and there are things that cause aneuploidy. And how do those relate to things that cause cancer?
Well, this is another very easy answer. All carcinogens that are known, that have been tested, evaluated, they cause abnormal numbers of chromosomes. They cause aneuploidy. All of them that have been tested do that. Many of the most powerful of these carcinogens do not cause gene mutations. That's been a thorn in the side of the gene mutation people from the very beginning. Their gene mutation tests do not show these very powerful carcinogens causing any gene mutations. So they're very powerful at causing cancer. And the thing that they have in common, just to reiterate, is that they cause aneuploidy, chromosomal imbalance. That's
so
what they do. It's that simple.
How do things cause aneuploidy? Like, are some of them chemical, some of them physical?
Yeah. Anything that causes chromosomal imbalance is a carcinogen. Radiation can do that. We talked about this in our 2014 interview, I believe. You can have radiation, even a single photon or an alpha particle, go through the cytoplasm, miss the nucleus entirely, and you can still cause chromosomal imbalance, because the spindle apparatus, the machinery that pulls the chromosomes apart during cell division, is in the cytoplasm. It's not in the nucleus.
Oh. And
you can disrupt that, destroy it, and by doing that. Another thing, the mechanical carcinogens, like asbestos, these little needles, the actual physical dimensions of these asbestos particles, they don't have to be. It could be anything. It could be glass fibers. It could be these nanofibers. Anything with the particular carcinogenic dimensions, which means that they have to be a certain range of length and a diameter to get inside cells on their own. And then they stick in, basically they clog up the microtubules by sticking in them, and they prevent those, they're like muscular proteins that pull the chromosomes apart, and the asbestos fibers will prevent that, and one of the chromosomes that should go to one side of one cell doesn't and stays in the other one, so there's one too many copies of that chromosome in the one daughter cell and one too few in the other daughter cell, and it causes aneuploidy. The thing that's absolutely crucial, there's two things that you have to have for cancer, two things. One is you have to have generate aneuploid cells, chromosomally unbalanced cells, a population of them, because generally it's like buying a lottery ticket. If you just do it one here and there, and these things are always damaged, even the cancer cells are damaged, they just don't go anywhere. So you need a population. It's like buying a lot of lottery tickets. In order for one of these things or a few of them to actually get the right assortment of chromosomes so that they survive enough to divide, you know, and even if they survive, they may not divide. And then when they divide, so that's one thing, you have to get this population of aneuploid cells, then they have to divide. They have to progress. And every time they divide, they generate new populations of aneuploid cells that are very similar to where they came from in the sense that they're viable, and if they're not, they die off. But then that's why you need a population. Eventually, you build up a population of aneuploid cells, no two of which are identical. One of them is different.
Is there a balance between total randomness and some kind of pattern? Like, you know, do certain types of cancers have a pattern of aneuploidy of some kind? Are there constraints?
Not really. You get, since there's no two cancer cells alike, even in the same cancer. Now, think of a chess game. You know, there's only two moves that you can make in the opening move of a chess game, either a pawn or a knight.
Right.
So every chess game starts with either a pawn or a knight, and then there's a few other opening moves that you could even memorize. At some point, though, as you keep getting further and further in the game, you're generating a game of chess that's never been played anywhere in the world before and probably will never, ever be played again.
Right.
Certainly if you're at the grandmaster level, all right? So the initial hits of aneuploidy have to be tolerable. You know, like I said before, a Down syndrome is a very low amount of aneuploidy in order to even have the child survive.
Right.
You have the other chromosome, chromosome one. There's no example of a single person born living with
right.
that. So you have to have what's called near diploid or near normal aneuploidy in order for the cells to even have a chance of surviving. You know, eventually, though, you've got to get aneuploidy all the way up to 60 to 90 chromosomes. Remember, normal is 46. Mm-hmm. So you've got to have a way for these cells to get up to that 60 to 90 chromosomes that are seen in cancer cells. And they don't do it stepwise. They can't, because every time these cells divide, they get sicker and sicker and they die off.
Right.
So how do you get up there
in okay.
cancer? You do what is done in plants, in evolution, in animals, every place that is known where you can change in a massive way instantly from one cell type to another. You do what's called a chromosome doubling or tetraploidization or whatever, and the exact same thing happens in cancer. You get these near diploid, aneuploid cells. They're not going anywhere very far, because if they keep dividing, they just die. So at some point, some of them won't divide, but they'll go through another round of cell division, which means they double their chromosomes again, and they get, you know, instead of 92, and then divide back to 46, then they'll have the 92, and they'll double that up to, what is that, 184 or something like that. And then those will... those might divide, and then you're coming down with a population of chromosomes that are in the 90s,
right.
80, 90, or a little over. Now you've got an excess of chromosomes.
Okay, so
you have an excess of chromosomes, now you can afford to lose some, because you've got some
right.
that you can afford to lose, and they settle down into a region of about 60 to 90 chromosomes. Typically, about 70% of the chromosomes are aneuploid.
But the first aneuploid might be more than 60 to 90. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, and if it is, the cell almost always is so screwed up it dies.
Right. So, like the process of mitosis, the chromosomes divide, then they're pulled to other ends of the cell, and then the cell splits. So presumably something goes wrong in that process. Either the chromosomes are not pulled to the right place, or the cell doesn't divide.
Well, both of those things can happen. It's like I said, the asbestos will keep the chromosomes from being equally split. The radiation can destroy the spindle apparatus. It can also screw up the proteins that are attached to the chromosomes, and they can also split the chromosomes themselves. You know, I mean, there's many, you know, I like to say there's probably an infinite number of ways to crash a 747.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, who knows how many ways there are to generate aneuploidy?
Right. I mean, I'm just thinking about the general the general process. I mean, could it be that that the mitosis results in more of the chromosomes going to one side than the other?
And then it has to be that way. It has
yes.
to be that.
And then the cell, the smaller cell, probably dies because it only has a few chromosomes. And then you have almost
you can't make those predictions. The only prediction you can make is if there's one chromosome that's completely missing, it won't survive. The only exception is the Y chromosome. It's the only chromosome that could be missing, and the cell will still be viable, can still
okay.
survive.
Okay. So, I mean, that's interesting. So even these massively aneuploid cells, they still have at least one of everything.
Yeah, at least one of everything. And then many times the chromosomes are mixed and matched. They're clipped and... you know, cut here and there and reformed, and these are called marker chromosomes, and they're unique. That's one way that people can, when you've heard of, they talk about clonal cancer,
right.
is that they look at these marker chromosomes that they see them, and lots of, even though no two cancer cells are alike, you might see the same marker chromosome over and over and over again, you know, in these cells, which, and the odds of generating that exact marker chromosome, you know, are astronomical. Probably, you know, these large marker chromosomes, probably no two have ever existed. Identical ones have never existed. Every one of them is unique. But once you see it, then you say, aha, then it had to come from a precursor, you know, all the way back, and that's clonal. In other words, that came from a cell that had that very same marker chromosome. Even though no two cells are alike, it has a telltale sign of where it came from.
So you're saying that this marker chromosome is carried from one cell to the next through cell division?
Yes. One reason is because, you know, it has so many parts of other chromosomes on it. And remember, if you're missing any one part of the, if you're missing a whole chromosome, the thing won't live. Sometimes you will see of the whole chromosome, you'll see them in the cancer cells. They're missing entirely, like chromosome 4. There's no whole chromosome 4 or chromosome 1 or chromosome 2 or whatever. All right?
Right.
Guess where you will find it, though? Bits and pieces stitched together in other chromosomes that we call those marker chromosomes.
Okay, so...
And they cannot afford to lose that marker chromosome or else the thing will die.
So how does this affect cell metabolism when you've got too many of... you got at least one of everything, but you got too many of at least some chromosomes.
Well, yeah, I mean, it screws up. Everything is screwed up. There's... experimentally, this has been confirmed that the total amount of DNA and the total amount of a messenger RNA, RNA in general, and the total amount of cellular protein, those ratios, those relative amounts are constant, regardless of the what they call the karyotype or the chromosomes. It could be a diploid cell, a normal cell. The ratio between the DNA and the RNA and the protein of a normal cell is constant. The DNA to RNA to protein of an aneuploid cell is constant. These things are constant. It doesn't mean that the amounts of each individual protein is constant. It means the total amount, you know, if you were to weigh them. Right, okay. So the fact that you have this connection, and you have, if you double the DNA content, and then you double the RNA content, and you double the protein content, you will have profound effects on the size of the cell. For example, the nucleus of cancer cells are, you know, several times larger than normal cell because of all of the chromosomes that are there. And the cancer cells typically can be much larger than a normal cell. Now, the problem with the cell is, let's say you're talking about a sphere. You know, you have the surface area grows much smaller than the volume. So now you're screwing up all the relative proportions of surface proteins,
right,
and then the cytoplasmic proteins and all the dynamics that goes in there. You also have much, much more protein than you had in a normal cell. You don't have enough, mitochondria in a cell. They're very large things, and they can't be duplicated too much in these very crowded cells. There's just not enough energy to do it. So the mitochondria are not duplicated, but you have to make up for the energy loss somewhere. And this is where the good old Warburg effect comes in. Glycolysis, aerobic glycolysis. People have always wondered about the mystery of Warburg effect. Where does that come from? It comes from the fact that there's too much protein in these cancer cells and not enough energy.
We need a little bit more. So this is like anaerobic.
It's aerobic, though. You also have oxidative phosphorylation going on, mm-hmm, making ATP in the mitochondria, as well as making ATP in the cytoplasm using glycolysis. You're having two different sources of ATP, and glycolysis, I think, it's like 1,000 times faster than the mitochondria can produce ATP, even though it's much less efficient. But it's really, really fast. We're getting very technical here. I want this book for the average people.
Okay, let's start to pull it back together again. So how does the aneuploidy theory and your book change cancer prevention?
Well, since aneuploid, you have to have aneuploid cells in order to get cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that means carcinogens cause aneuploidy. So you try to identify the carcinogens in the environment and eliminate the ones that you can and reduce exposure to the ones that you cannot eliminate. That's one thing. Protect people against things that cause aneuploidy. And in Europe and in Japan, they've been doing that for many, many years. We don't do it as much in this country. They use the aneuploid diagnostics, things where they in vitro test where they look, or even in animals, to see if something causes aneuploidy. If it causes aneuploidy, they automatically assume it's a carcinogen, which in fact it is, and then they go from there. So prevention is fairly straightforward. Remove yourself from things that cause chromosomal imbalance.
What are some of the things that are aneuploid. Like, people know about asbestos, and I think even in the United States and right. Canada, where a lot of asbestos used to be mined, and I think some still is, I think people got the message on asbestos. But are there some compounds out there that are powerful aneuploidogens that people are really not taking enough care with? I mean, things like formaldehyde or stuff like that.
Oh, Lord, yes. I mean, one of the real things that's been really upsets me about the gene mutation people, they totally, totally ignore the environment. They totally ignore all the carcinogens out there. And I think one of the big reasons they ignore it is because these really powerful carcinogens don't cause gene mutations.
Right. So
they don't even talk about it anymore. And we could, there's an increase in cancer, especially since the 1980s, but certainly, you know, for the past couple of hundred years, and it's due to environmental causes, and we're not addressing that at all in this country.
Yes, and I think some people were excited about Donald Trump because of his position on questioning vaccines. But one of his big things has been eliminating regulations. And a lot of those regulations were put in place because people discovered that certain chemicals were toxic. And so therefore there were regulations that probably do reduce the profit of corporations because they have to protect their workers. They have to protect the people who are downstream, who are breathing the air that's coming out of the factory, et cetera, things like that. So getting rid of regulations is probably just going to increase the number of carcinogens in the environment.
The regulations aren't doing that much in right now anyway. There's just not enough public pressure on. There's certainly not in the cancer researchers. I never hear them talking about carcinogens. Never. They don't talk about it.
I had a foolish thought. I was going to say, if it was something as obvious as a gun, you pull the trigger, bullet goes in head, person dies, people could get it, and then they'd do something about it. But then I thought, oh, this is America, where even though it's that obvious that you pull the trigger and somebody dies, you still don't do anything to stop the killing. So if
I guarantee you, the molecular biologist would look for the molecular pathway that led to death in the gunshot
of the brain. Okay, so how does this change cancer treatment?
Well, in a number of ways. First of all carcinogens that I've been able to find and to study, chemotherapy, cancer chemotherapy, all of the cancer chemotherapy that I've been able to evaluate causes cancer itself. They're all carcinogens.
And so is radiation.
And so is radiation.
And even surgery can cause tumors to metastasize.
Not only that, just even biopsies can. It's something like a few percent every year. You have a benign tumor, for example, and you go in, and it's these aneuploid cells. If they're aneuploid benign tumors, and they can't escape, they can't keep progressing by dividing because they haven't gotten to that magic number of the right number of chromosomes to cause invasion and things. If you free them up by biopsy now they're free to, or surgery, and they're free to divide. Now they can progress. Now they can progress and turn a benign tumor into cancer. And this is known, the surgeons know this very well, that there is a small chance of turning a benign tumor into a cancer by doing the procedure of biopsy and or surgery. So, but it didn't really cause it. It released a cancer that was a nascent cancer to begin with.
Yes. So we have, we're starting to come towards the end of our time. So I'd just like you to add any thoughts that we haven't managed to get to yet, and then we'll go through your book at the end just to give people a chance to find out more about it.
I've thought, how to promote this thing, try to raise some more money and get people interested, trying to do everything we can to think about this. I've decided I'm going to interview people here and have discussions, invite them to our house here in Greensboro, and have them just ask me questions about cancer and record it, audio, and let people hear these questions. And I told them that if I haven't already addressed it in the book, I will address it and or answer their questions in the book, and also immediately to people. And I want to start doing that on this website, on the Indiegogo website, and possibly I have a Facebook account too. Mm-hmm. And you look at what's called The Nature of Cancer. If you're in Facebook, people just type in The Nature of Cancer, all one word, and it pops up. And then the Indiegogo thing, if you're there, do a search for precarious balance, two words, and it pops up my the Indiegogo thing there.
And which is so, also what cancer really is.
Yeah, that's like a subtitle, what cancer really is. And that's really what the book's about. And also on these websites, I'm asking people to send me their questions, things right. that they would like to see answered in the book. And I'll be happy to do it if I haven't done it already. And just trying to drum up some more interest in this thing. I certainly am really looking for an illustrator, somebody that can turn complex issues or concepts into, you know, make them simple and clear. Sort of right. the Richard Feynman approach.
Okay, well, I will include links to your Indiegogo page and a Facebook page in the show notes. And if there's any illustrators out there who'd like to bid for this work, feel free to contact me or Raz, and hopefully we can help make this book come to fruition. You would think this would be a big deal, but I think that the normal process of understanding of cancer in modern humans is that you spend your life up to before your diagnosis of cancer or before some loved one is diagnosed, being immersed in the propaganda about how wonderful yeah. the cancer treatment system is, stuff like that, how cancer just kind of comes out of the sky, doesn't really have any reason, it's just bad luck that you get it. And then all of a sudden, you or a loved one is faced with, you have cancer, get your things in order, we'll do what we can, and you fall into getting what they tell you. And even if you go for multiple opinions, the chances are that they're just going to give you different combinations of chemo, radiation, and surgery, which are like the three things that kind of mutate in the cancer industry. And people don't really have the time at that point to learn enough about cancer to make a more intelligent decision. They're scared. You don't make good decisions when you're panicking, when you can hardly breathe, let alone do anything else.
But there's hope. There's hope. We didn't get into that. But cancer is definitely preventable. It's definitely treatable. It's definitely curable. They're curing it in Germany right now, also in Mexico and other places. I know leaving the program at that point, everybody's gasping, what is the answer? Well, come to my website, get my book.
Okay. Well, that's a good teaser yeah. for your book. Thank you very much for joining me today, Raz. I appreciate
Thanks,
it. It's always
bro.
A pleasure.
I appreciate it, too.
Yeah. Always a Thank pleasure you. To talk to you. All Goodbye. Right.
See you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 174 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.